The reason the Ronin included us in their attack was that they thought we scholars who read foreign books and taught foreign culture were liars trying to mislead the people and make way for the Westerners to exploit Japan. So, we also became their prey. One of my colleagues in the government service, Tezuka Ritsuzo, had a really narrow escape. Once, when he was visiting the headquarters of the Choshu clan, he'd made some mention of foreign affairs. At that, the young men in service on the estate, taking him to be an outspoken advocate of free exchange, suddenly fell upon him. Tezuka ran for his life, followed by the young men with drawn swords. Unable to outrun them, he saved himself by leaping into the moat near Hibiya, though it was a cold season for swimming. Yet I could not think of giving up my major interest or chosen studies. I decided that it would be useless to worry over the predicament. In the midst of such disturbances within our land, England demanded satisfaction for the murder of Richardson. British fleet arrived in Edo in the spring of the third year of Bunkyun to present their formal demands. These terms required the payment of £100,000 by the central government and £25,000 by the clan of Satsuma, and the execution of the murderer before British representatives. A period of 20 days was fixed for reply. This indemnity document came on the 19th of February. As I was one of the interpreters in the service, I was sent for at night to the residence of the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Akasaka. With my colleagues, I worked till dawn, translating the long letter from the British. All the while, we were afraid to think what might be the outcome of our own translation. 2 days later, the Shogun, apparently unaware of the imminent crisis, set out from Edo for Kyoto to visit the Emperor. With the Shogun absent, naturally any decision of the government had to wait. Soon, the period of 20 days had expired. The confusion in Edo was becoming acute. People were sure there would be war. Many residents prepared to escape to the country. There were even rumors as to exactly when the shooting would begin. There was another postponement of 20 days, then 10 more days of grace. While the government kept putting off an answer, I felt that war was inevitable after all, and began preparations for escape to a safer position than my house in Shinsenza. The end of the last postponement drew near, and the British declared that there could be no more putting off, even for a day. As I was in the Bureau of Translation, I knew every detail of the situation, and the suspense was unbearable. Once, I was ordered to translate a letter from the French minister, de Bellecourt. I don't know what his purpose was, but the minister made a downright assertion that France was absolutely on the side of England in the present problem, and in the event of open hostilities, the French fleet would be ordered to bombard Edo in alliance with the British. Our government was simply worrying about the threats and bullying of the European diplomats and could not decide what to do. As matters became more acute, the senior officials pretended they were ill, and none of them would attend the conferences. 2 days before the absolutely final day of reckoning, I gathered together my furniture and made ready to move to Aoyama, where a friend, the physician Kure Koseki, lived. As I passed by the drill grounds on the seashore of Shinsenza, I noticed the cannons turned seaward, ready for action. I believed war was inevitable. At that time, I had several students staying in my household and had on hand a sum of about 150 ryu in gold tubu coins. As we might all be separated in the rush of a fleeing crowd, I thought it better to divide this money rather than to have myself or my wife carry all of it together. Then each one would have something to rely upon in a crisis. Thus equipped, we were ready for the next day's war. But an unforeseen event happened. One of the senior officers in the government set out from Edo in a war vessel. His vessel was promptly followed by an English gunboat. It was reported that the English boat intended to fire if the Japanese vessel steered straight out to the sea, because the minister had made it known that he was sailing to the province of the West. Unexpectedly, the ship veered to Yokohama. The minister landed and went directly to the British minister. The minister handed the £100,000 indemnity in silver coins on his own responsibility. The crisis was over between the countries for a while. The next move of the English was towards Kagoshima, the capital of the Satsuma clan, to demand a further indemnity of £25,000 for the family of the deceased and the execution of the man who had killed Richardson. The English officers, Admiral Cooper, Commander Wilmot, and Captain Jostling of the flagship, then waited for the reply. When it was long delayed, they decided to commandeer as their temporary security the two ships which Satsuma had purchased from Europe. They were about to tow these ships out from their moorings near the island of Sakurajima in the bay, when, in sudden retaliation, the clansmen on shore opened fire. The English ships returned salvos, and thus, the Battle of Kagoshima began. One of the largest of the round shells exploded on deck and killed the commander-in-chief and the captain, besides wounding several others. The English fire, in turn, was quite as destructive, and most of the town near the seashore was demolished. Yet, after all, there was no decisive victory. After they had made peace and paid the £25,000, the Englishman casually asked them to return their salvaged anchor. The Satsuma officials, without a second thought evidently, delivered the anchor as if it was so much scrap iron. This amply shows how little the Japanese knew of international ethics at that time. From the very beginning, it is doubtful whether it was reasonable at all for England to demand the sum of £125,000 for the death of a single man. Although it is now an affair of 30 years ago, when things without precedent were happening daily, we Japanese still feel the injustice of that demand and settlement. When the Satsuma men proposed a truce, what enormous threats and boasts the British minister made, and how naively the Japanese believed or were afraid to disbelieve. Indeed, the whole issue was closed before the Japanese people really knew what they were up against. Even the Americans were saying at the time that they hoped Japan would not pay the full amount. And when I recall how the minister from France came out with his most amazing threats, I begin to doubt the sanity of the men concerned. From the imperial court in Kyoto, there was issued an edict that, beginning on the 10th of May, the third year of Bunkyu, the expulsion of all foreigners was to be enforced. It seemed as if there was nothing but anti-foreign agitation in the country. The shogunate was now harassed on both sides. There was, on one side, the agitating clans, which clamoured at the point of arms for the closing of the country, and on the other side was the united power of Western nations, demanding the open door. The shogunate, as the governing force, had lost all its prestige. There were almost daily assassinations. The country had become a fearful place to live in. In this state of affairs, I tried to live as discreetly as possible, for my chief concern had become how I might escape with life and limb. In the third year of Keio, I had the opportunity again of going to the United States of America. It was my third voyage to foreign lands. Some years previously, when the shogunate had considered obtaining some warships, they had requested the American minister, Robert H. Proyne, to negotiate the purchase, and handed him the amount of $800,000 in several payments. In the third or fourth year of the Bunkyu era, one vessel, named the Fujisan had been delivered. The cost of this had been $400,000. Since then, various affairs had occupied the government, and the Civil War in the United States had broken up her foreign interests. And so, the delivery of the second ship had been much delayed. It was decided to send over a mission to conclude the purchase of the second ship, and also to obtain some rifles for the army. In this same year, a regular packet service was opened between Japan and America. The first vessel to arrive was the Colorado, and we took passage on her return voyage. It was a fast steamer of 4,000 tons, veritably palatial in comparison with the small boat on which I had previously crossed. The former had required 37 days. The rapid liner arrived in San Francisco on the 22nd day. There were as yet no transcontinental railways, so we embarked again for Panama by the Pacific Steamship Company line after a wait of about 2 weeks. We crossed the Isthmus by train and then again took ship to New York, our voyage ending on March 19th. We went directly to Washington and called on the Secretary of State at once to proceed with our deal. The way the business was done certainly illustrates our government of those days. It would be supposed that before we sailed from Japan, the mission would have had a receipt for the $800,000 that had been duly paid. But in reality, there was hardly anything that could be recognized as an official voucher. Our files included some 10 pieces of paper with simple notations of $50,000, $100,000, etc. But there was no statement of how or for what purpose Mr. Proin had received the money. Among the papers were several oddly shaped sheets with nothing but the amounts and the name Pruyu inscribed. The American parties might easily, if so inclined, have assumed a skeptical air and refused to honour such pieces of paper. There was much discussion among the members of the mission before the voyage, but they decided finally that this apparent neglect could be made a proof of friendship between the two countries. Japan had trusted the American minister. Rather, the Japanese government had put its faith in the goodwill of the American government, and no formal agreement was deemed necessary. The papers were simply memoranda in which we would not place any importance. Having decided upon this attitude, which was due to the force of circumstance, when we opened the negotiations, we were greeted at once by Mr. Proin himself. Without any hesitation or formality, he wanted to know if we would take a ship or have the surplus fund returned. The mission felt relieved at this fine attitude of the American ex-minister. We were taken on a tour of inspection and finally decided on a steel craft named the Stonewall, later called by us Azumakan. Then we purchased several hundred or several thousand rifles. Still, some $70,000 or $80,000 of our fund remained, and this we left in the care of the American government. It was not until the following year, the first year of the Meiji era, that the ship reached Japan. Then, with the new year, in early January, came the Battle of Fushimi, the defeat of the Shogun's army, and the retreat back to Edo of Shogun Yoshinobu himself. Again, great confusion swept the country, and this marked the beginning of the Imperial Restoration. Though I did not engage in politics, I was not entirely ignorant of the political world. On the voyage to Europe, I used to talk over the problems of the time with the other interpreters, Matsuki and Mizukuri. "What do you think of it?" I said one day. "The shogunate cannot hold the country together much longer. It seems to me that all the clans might get together and form a federation, like Germany. What do you say to this idea?" Matsuki and Mizukuri agreed with me that this would be the most peaceful solution to the crisis. Then going on to talk about our own careers, I said, "If I should say what I'd like to do, if I could, I would like to become tutor to the big chief with a salary of 200 bales of rice a year and the chance of teaching him all the new ideas of civilization and bringing about a great reformation to the country." But to return to the contemporary situation in the country, I noticed when I looked around that all the Ronin, adventurers and so-called patriots had collected in Kyoto around the imperial cause. The shogunate in Edo, on the other hand, was trying to keep its own as the central government against this rising power. These two political forces had come to be called Kinno, the supporters of the emperor, and Sabaku, the supporters of the shogun. If I may sum up my position between these two sides. Number one, I disliked the bureaucratic, oppressive, conservative, anti-foreign policy of the shogunate, so I could not side with it. But two, yet the followers of the imperial cause were still more anti-foreign and more violent in their action, so I had even less sympathy with them. Number three, regardless of right or wrong, an ambitious man might cast his lot with one or other of the parties to win a place for himself, for in a troubled time, one can best do a big thing. But there was no such desire in me. Another instance of the stubborn conservatism of an official may be pertinent here. I was reading Chambers' book on economics. When I spoke of the book to a certain high official in the Treasury Bureau one day, he became much interested and wanted me to show him a translation. I at once began translating it when I came upon the word competition, for which there was no equivalent in Japanese. After trying several words, I was obliged to use an invention of my own, kyoso, literally race fight. When the official saw my translation, he appeared much impressed. Then he said suddenly, "Here is a word. Fight. What does it mean? It's such an unpeaceful word." "That is nothing new," I replied. "That is exactly what all Japanese merchants are doing. If one merchant begins to sell things cheap, his neighbour will try to sell them even cheaper. Or if one merchant improves his merchandise to attract more buyers, another will try to take the trade from him by offering goods of still better quality. Thus, all merchants race and fight, and this is the way money values are fixed." I understand now. "But don't you think there is too much effort in Western affairs?" "I don't consider that too much effort. All the commerce of the world is conducted fundamentally like that." "Yes, perhaps," went on the official. "I understand the idea, but that word, fight, is not conducive to peace. I would not take the paper with that word to the Chancellor for his judgment." From the gentleman's exception to my rendering of the term, I suppose he would rather have seen such phrases as "men being kind to each other" in a book on economics. Doubtless the official would have approved of a book that advocated man's loyalty to his lord, a love of the nation shown in connection with trade, open generosity from a merchant in times of national stress, etc. From this little incident, one may gather the character of the other officials whom he represented in the government. When the invading army did come, however, it proved to be very well disciplined, and no unreasonable violence was ever done. Peace and a stable government established, in April of that year, my school structure was finished. It may seem that I was unreasonably severe in hatred of the government, but the whole reason of my stand was that I believed the new government to be carrying out the ancient policy of exclusiveness and antagonism against Western culture, and I feared that the change from shogunate to imperial regime would bring no good to the country. I have never told anyone of the dire, helpless state of my mind at that time, but I will confess it now. Watching the unfortunate condition of the country, I feared in reality that we might not be able to hold our own against foreign aggressiveness. Yet no one in all the land was there with whom I could talk over my anxiety, no one anywhere, east, west, north or south, as I searched, whom I could depend on. As I look back today, over 30 years since, it all seems like a dream. How advanced and secure the country is now. I can do nothing but bless with a full heart this glorious enlightenment of Japan today.